This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Weeks of stay-at-home orders are creating space for families to spend more time together than ever before. And for some, that means more bonding activities. But for others, it creates conditions for a dangerous situation. The coronavirus pandemic has led to isolation, disrupted routines, and economic struggles. Child welfare advocates say those conditions can lead to more violence in the home. And this means there may be another public health crisis swelling alongside COVID-19. Anna Gassman-Pines is with me. She's a professor of public policy, psychology, and neuroscience at Duke University. She studies child welfare, low-wage work, and family life. And she joins us now. Welcome back, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you. And I know that you're working on a survey right now, in fact, of hourly service workers. A survey that you started before the crisis got into full swing. What are you seeing so far?
That's right. So my colleague, Elizabeth Onanot from Barnard College, and I have been following a group of service workers with young children, and we were surveying them every day, asking questions about their work experiences and also their own feelings and how their children were doing. We had started that work in February before this crisis really became full-blown, and were able to track parents' well-being as more and more restrictions were put into place. And what we saw was that parent mental health problems really have shot up since the crisis became quite serious. And they're also reporting that their children are having more behavior problems.
Well, I mean, that's interesting to think about this survey in the midst of all of this. And obviously, you undertook this survey because you had a sense that something was going on even before this. Am I right? What was the genesis of the report?
That's right. So the work that we were doing was interested in understanding instability and unpredictability in the work schedules of hourly service workers, and how that unpredictability and instability in schedules makes it hard for parents to establish routines and balance their dual roles as workers and parents. And one thing that this crisis has really made clear is that things were already really difficult, especially for low-wage workers, and if anything, they've gotten much worse since the restrictions on non-essential businesses have been put into place.
So what are some of the details in the survey so far that stand out for you?
So one of the things that stands out the most to us is, in addition to these daily surveys, we also went back to these parents and asked at one time, how are you doing during this crisis in particular? And one thing that really stood out is how quickly and dramatically families have lost income. So 2/3 of the families in our sample have lost income since the crisis started. And for many of those families, they've lost more than half their income. And so what they're telling us in the survey then is that this is having real repercussions for their ability to pay for basic needs like rent and food.
See, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, there are so many paradoxes and contradictions in this entire pandemic that we're experiencing. But the loss of income, obviously, is paramount. And, you know, because on the other side, uncertainty is one of the worst aspects, I would think, of low-wage jobs. You have to work multiple jobs. You are at the whim of a manager. You may be taking public transportation. All of that is racing through your head. One of the things that has happened in this pandemic is that there's a little bit, you're at home, and there's a little more stability in at least that situation. But obviously, at home with no income is now the driving force, and it doesn't bring much peace.
Well, that's exactly right. So these parents had a lot to juggle even before this crisis, for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. A lot of times they are required to be on call, so they don't know whether they'll actually be needed for a shift or not, and only find out perhaps the night before. And then they have to manage childcare, transportation, and so forth. So you're exactly right. There was already a lot of uncertainty and unpredictability in their daily lives. Now what parents are telling us is that they have uncertainty about how they're going to be able to pay their bills.
What is, how does this play out? Do you have any sense of what this means for the children who are at home in terms of their safety?
Well, what we know from our prior work on more typical economic downturns, work that we and other social scientists have done, is that when there are large job losses in communities, child maltreatment rates go up. So this is true for both children in families where the parents have lost jobs, but also more broadly true in a community that's really been hard hit by an economic downturn. Everyone in that community feels an increased sense of instability and uncertainty about whether they'll be able to keep their job. And that kind of increased stress and strain on families can really lead to difficult circumstances that can lead to child maltreatment.
And of course, these things, when they happen, are often exposed, and you know, we start to deal with them because they become evident to the surrounding community. But now that we're behind closed doors, it is less evident. I want to include the experience of John Lauterbach. He's the executive director of Safe Light Incorporated in Hendersonville. It's a nonprofit agency for survivors of interpersonal violence, sexual assault, and child abuse. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Well, we have not seen a rise in domestic violence in Henderson County, or at least a rise in domestic violence that we know about. We hypothesize that that could be due to the stay-at-home orders. Survivors are just not comfortable calling for help when the abuser is right there all the time. But we are assuming that when the stay-at-home orders are loosened, we will see a tremendous increase in calls for help. And we'll do the best we can to be there for everybody.
It's John Lauterbach, executive director of Safe Light Incorporated in Hendersonville, talking about the rise in domestic violence and child abuse now with Anna Gassman Pines from Duke University. So, Anna, this is, if it's happening and if it's growing, it is all happening behind closed doors. Is there any way to detect this? I mean, schools used to be one place where staff and teachers had been trained in looking for signs, but I'm wondering if that's even available now, even with online classes.
That's right. So that's a big concern, I think, that is well-founded. There's very good social science evidence that teachers being mandated reporters have a really important role in helping us learn when there are cases of child maltreatment. And children also come into contact in regular times with many different adults who can help them if it comes to light that there may be child maltreatment in that family. Now with the stay-at-home orders, and especially with children being out of school, a really important warning system has been taken away. And I know that school districts are working very hard to maintain contact with families, that teachers around our state are doing all they can to maintain contact with families. But it's probably not the same as a teacher seeing a child in a classroom in person day in and day out.
Yeah, and for the entire day, because, you know, you can prepare yourself for your lesson in your class with your teacher for that Zoom conference, whereas if you're walking around for 5 hours in that building, somebody's going to notice something.
That's right. And we just know that teachers are such an important frontline group of adults who are keeping an eye on all of our children, that this is something we are all really going to need to be paying attention to.
What do you think this, you hinted at it earlier, talking about larger communities that are vulnerable, but what does this pandemic show us about our communities in North Carolina, particularly those that had already been vulnerable?
So I think what the virus is really revealing is how much pre-existing inequality there already was in our state and across the country. That's true for by income. So just the different experiences of low-wage hourly service workers, for example, compared to higher-wage salaried workers. But the virus has also really highlighted tremendous racial disparities. We know that African Americans are hit much harder in terms of their health by this virus. And that is actually not disconnected from income inequality and wealth inequality that we see here in North Carolina and around the country.
What's interesting, too, and I wonder what this means for policy, because we've been stripping social service programs for the past several decades now in the name of business efficiency. Theory is, if you lower taxes, for instance, and don't spend as much on social spending, those businesses will provide jobs, and those jobs will provide the security that people need and not social services. And now we're seeing that those jobs that they were offering didn't provide the kind of security they need. And I guess, in terms of social policy, there's a real lesson in this, is there not?
Well, I think that's right. So you could take paid family and medical leave, for example. I, as a Duke University employee, am very fortunate that because of my job, I have access to paid family and medical leave as one of my benefits. But connecting benefits with employment raises several concerns about inequality. One is that they're differentially accessible. So paid family and medical leave is much more likely for high income, high earners than it is for low wage, low income workers. Very, very few low wage workers have access to paid family and medical leave through their jobs. And now in the midst of this health crisis, we see how important this kind of insurance protection is. Anyone can fall ill because of this virus. Anyone can have a close family member who falls ill, for whom they need to take care of that person. And what a paid family and medical leave insurance does is allow someone who has fallen ill themselves or who needs to care for an ill family member to continue to have some income while they're away from work.
We'll continue our conversation with Anna Gassman-Pines on the state of things in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Weeks of stay-at-home orders are creating space for families to spend time together. Domestic violence, though, is surging here and around the globe as families are on lockdown trying to slow the spread of the coronavirus. In fact, the Secretary General of the United Nations this month called for measures to address the problem. Here in North Carolina, advocates for violence, domestic violence, and survivors are worried about what's happening. I've been talking with Anna Gassman-Pines, who is a professor of public policy, psychology, and neuroscience at Duke University. And Anna, before the break, we were talking about what is the public policy implications, the idea that just creating any old job is going to make things better for everybody has now been exposed as not entirely true. What are some of the other public policy implications, do you think, that come out of this with respect to domestic violence?
So the other public policy implication that we're really seeing play out here in North Carolina and across the country is that we have chosen to make our social services difficult to access, with the idea being that only the people who need them the most will be able to access them, and that people who don't really need these social services therefore won't. And unfortunately, what that means is that our systems are not set up to be quick and responsive when there is this tremendous need, as we've seen, for example, with our unemployment insurance program.
Anna, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Gassman-Pines is a professor of public policy and psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. Well, as I said, here in North Carolina, the advocates for domestic violence survivors are very worried about the toll that stay-at-home orders will take on families in unsafe situations. Emily McCool is managing partner for Scharf Law Firm, who specializes in representing survivors, and she joins me now. Emily, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You say that one of the biggest misconceptions about domestic violence is the idea that many people have that it can't happen in their home. Where does this idea come from?
That's right. You know, a lot of people think that domestic violence, first of all, is just physical violence. And so if they don't see bruises, they don't see broken bones on friends and family members, they think, first of all, it doesn't happen to their friends and families. They think it can't happen to them. But we know that domestic violence, even before COVID-19, was already an epidemic that we have been dealing with, a public health crisis, that one in four women and one in seven men will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And with those kinds of numbers, there's not a listener out there who isn't impacted, even if they don't know it, that a friend or a family member or that they themselves at some point may experience domestic violence, whether it's physical or emotional, whether it's stalking. And so understanding that domestic violence has such a huge impact in our community, and even right now, even more so, as Dr. Gassman-Tynes alluded to, with the different stay-at-home orders and things that are exacerbating the problem.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that and how and what you expect to see as a result, because it's precisely the factors that are causing all of this, the results of this, loss of income, staying at home, compressed living quarters, all of that would be making matters worse, would it not?
That's absolutely correct. That, you know, here we have domestic violence, which feeds on an abusive partner who uses power and control over the victim in this relationship. And they use isolation as one of their key tactics. And so when we're dealing with a pandemic that necessarily has to have people isolate and has to have people have these stay-at-home orders and social distancing to protect folks from COVID-19, abusers instead are able to use that in order to further isolate their partners from community resources, to use that as a measure to have power and control over their partner.
What are you expecting to see? Because, again, so many of these factors were already in play, and now it's happening behind closed doors and for a period of 2 months. And we heard from John in Hendersonville, for instance, who runs a shelter, who said, well, we actually haven't seen an increase yet, and he understands why. Nobody's been able to call. People are afraid to call. What do you expect to see when this is lifted?
Well, I expect a couple of things. One, I think that he's absolutely right, that one of the barriers is that folks are under this constant surveillance by their abusive partners, so they have limited access to reach out for assistance. And so I do think he's correct that we may see a spike in accessing those support services once they have the ability to do so. But I think the other problem is a lack of awareness, that a lot of survivors out there think that everything is shut down. And so I think it's really important that we are increasing awareness to make sure that survivors know that help is still available to them, that programs like his are open and they remain open. They may have had to adjust some of the ways they're operating, but their crisis lines are still open, their shelters are still open, that courts are still open for the filing of emergency restraining orders, and that they can still access those, that Legal Aid of North Carolina is still accepting clients and helping them through the process right now. So I think getting the word out that they know those resources are available right now.
And yet there is so much fear surrounding all of this. I want to listen to what it's like to be in a shelter. Liz Day spoke with us. Liz spent a month in a domestic shelter, and that was about 10 years ago. But let's listen to her experience.
I was placed in protective custody while we were awaiting for my abuser to be arrested. I also had a 9-month-old son who was also placed in the shelter with me as well. It is definitely the scariest experience ever because you're going into something completely unknown. You have no idea what to expect whenever they say, okay, we need to take you to this place to keep you safe. And most of them are full of a bunch of other women and their children going through the same exact thing. And they all are terrified. I mean, you can feel the anxiety in the air while also, in a sense, there's a bit of safety because there's a pack of us. But at the same time, we're all apprehensive. We know what to expect and we know we're not safe.
That's Liz Day from outside of Raleigh describing her time in a domestic violence shelter about 10 years ago, talking about the increase in intimate partner violence now because of stay-at-home orders with attorney and advocate Emily McCool. So what happens if you think about people who are confined and realize that they may not be able, even if they have access, the courts are open for domestic cases like this, shelters are open, they may not feel like they can call. If you're forced to stay in that situation without calling for help, what kind of impact does that have later on when when this person might be able to get help?
So you're absolutely right. It's to be able to have to survive for weeks or months living in that situation 24/7 with an abusive partner and having little to no access to support right now is an enormous emotional toll on someone's mental health, on their physical health. Survivors of domestic violence are oftentimes literally walking on eggshells when they're with their abusive partner, trying to gauge how is their mood, how are they going to react, what do I need to do to placate them. And if you can imagine literally having to be in that situation with their abusive partner day in and day out without an escape and having nowhere to go and trying to protect themselves and their child, that is physically and emotionally exhausting. And so having to delay resources and support can truly be physically and emotionally harmful and cause such an amount of trauma for them that we are going to really need to be ready to provide resources when these stay-at-home orders are lifted.
You represent domestic violence survivors. What were some of the obstacles they faced in criminal court before this pandemic?
The criminal justice system is oftentimes not set up in a way that makes it easy for victims of domestic violence to access justice. And there are a lot of barriers, whether it's from accessing physically going to court, transportation, childcare, or the way that court dates are set months and months out. Oftentimes survivors get very frustrated with the length of process that it takes, or the fact that the court systems are really overwhelmed with the volume. And oftentimes prosecutors don't have the time that they want to have to spend individually on these cases, talking to survivors. And at the end of the day, sometimes survivors want different things than prosecutors want. And so they have a lot of barriers towards getting access from the criminal justice system while the abusive partner is oftentimes putting pressure on them, manipulating them, and even threatening them about what happens with the process.
What are some suggestions you have for someone who might be concerned about a friend or a relative in an abusive situation?
The number one thing I would say is to don't stop reaching out to them while needing to be thoughtful about the fact that they may be under surveillance. And so being intentional about your connection, that connection right now is so important. And so reaching out to friends and family members that you may be concerned about and staying connected as much as possible and being thoughtful about it. So don't specifically ask them if they may be in danger, knowing that an abusive partner may be reading those text messages, listening to phone calls, but staying connected and asking them what you can do to support them. And if there are particular platforms that are safe for them, but staying connected and supporting them.
I'm talking to Amalie McCool, managing partner at Scharf Law Firm that specializes in representing domestic violence survivors. Survivors often turn to social workers for help in getting out of an abusive situation or accessing resources. They're on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic as people struggle with economic uncertainty, fear, and anxiety. But just like every other job, the nature of their work has changed.
A lot of social workers are transitioning to telehealth, which is a big transition for a lot of folks. When you're used to being in person and having a connection with your client, being able to see them in person, pick up on a lot of those cues like body language, it's harder to see when you're doing it via teletherapy. But there are a lot of social workers like child welfare workers, hospital social workers who work with individuals experiencing homelessness are still on the front lines. And I just want to reiterate that social workers are essential workers and their services have not been put on hold during this pandemic.
That was Valerie Arndt, Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers, North Carolina chapter. Licensed clinical social worker Kathy Douglas joins us now to talk about her work and how that has changed. She owns Stepping Forward Counseling in Lincolnton. Kathy, welcome.
Hello.
How has your practice changed now since the stay-at-home orders went into effect in North Carolina?
Tremendously. I am doing all teletherapy now, and a lot of rural private practice therapists have seen a decrease in our business just because people don't necessarily trust the virtual world. So as far as the discussion that we're having today, I have seen some of my clients have these issues with increasing stress in their homes, leading to potential domestic violence situations. And it's difficult to always assess when you're not face-to-face with someone.
How is it? I know that you have a friend who works with local social services. What are you hearing about their response?
They are busier than they have ever been. They are actually getting calls from parents themselves asking for help, which doesn't happen very often. I've been a social worker for a long time, and that's not the norm. So parents are feeling that frustration, and they're feeling their patience is lessening, and they are presented with needing assistance in how do I deal with having my child. Now I'm homeschooling, the income issues, and they're asking for help. So social services has definitely seen an increase in those calls.
And it's getting difficult even to find shelters. Is that right?
It is. You know, Lincolnton is still considered a rural community. Our shelter is very small and can only take so many folks at a time. So that's making it difficult to get resources for folks. You know, you have tell someone to call, and then there's no place for them to go.
Have you had that experience where you've had a client that just doesn't have any place to go?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have. And I do have her permission to speak about her particular case.
Well, tell us about it.
So this young lady is a full-time college student, and called her college has a student assistant counseling program, which I'm a part of, and called to get some assistance with stress. And in those conversations, this has been completely virtual counseling, she was able to tell me that she did not feel safe in her home. A lot of emotional abuse that has escalated to physical aggression. And like I said, and trying to get resources for her, that's difficult. Her partner checks her phone every day, checks her email every day, restricts her movements. She does have family in the area, but often he takes her car keys before he leaves for work. So it's been very tough.
What's going to happen? Is she going to stay there? And because you said there's no place at the moment, what do you do when you have a case like that?
Well, what I did in this particular case was get her permission to connect with her family, and so I've had some conversations with her family, and they are supportive in helping her get out of this situation. But that's a tricky thing. He has left work and just shown up in the middle of the day. And so she doesn't often know when he'll be there. So making an exit plan is complicated.
Well, I know I've left you very little time for this next question, but I also know you deal with police officers and first responders when domestic violence escalates in the home. Sometimes they're the first ones there, and you help debrief some of them. What kind of toll is this taking on first responders who have to respond to these calls?
It has been very difficult. You know, just they're concerned about exposure to COVID-19, and they go on these calls, and again, because we're in a rural community with limited resources, they often don't have a place to take folks. Even if that person is willing to leave the home, there's no place for them to go. And so they are very frustrated. I spoke with some police officers before the stay-at-home orders were issued, and their biggest concern, they knew that this was going to be an issue, an increase in calls and limited resources for the folks they're trying to serve. So it's very stressful because they want to help and they can't.
Talking to Kathy Douglas, a licensed clinical social worker, the owner of Stepping Forward Counseling in Lincolnton. Kathy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely.
I want to thank Emily McCool as well, who spoke with us earlier, managing partner at Scharf Law Firm. If you or your family need support, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE, 1-800-799-7233.